Welcome back, everyone, to Shuttlepod at the Disco, episode 12, which, of course, corresponds to Discovery, episode 13. The episode we're reviewing is what's past as prologue. My name is Jared Whitley. I'm here with my good friends, Brian Drew.
Hello, everybody.
And the inimitable Matthew Wright.
Hi, guys. Inimitable, wow.
Okay, so what's past is prologue. Episode 13 was written by Ted Sullivan and directed by Olatunde Osunsanmi. We're excited to get
into
this.
Well done, Jared.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I wanted to be sure not to make a mistake on that. Okay, so what was your general reactions to the episode? Matt, what did you think of it? Why don't you start it off for us?
Sure. I have mixed feelings about this episode. There were lots of kind of fun, exciting action beats to it, and some less impressive one-dimensionality sort of shown here and there that we'll get into. And I also have to say, though, I did really love the Saru's speech towards the end. It was really great. So,
yeah, I think Saru is a popular character. I always enjoy seeing him on screen.
Yeah, I think so, too. He's become
absolutely.
Kicks butt.
Yeah,
you know
he fits the actor fits the role very, very well.
I agree.
But Brian, what did you think of the episode?
I have similar thoughts to Matt. I liked the way it was directed. I thought it was beautifully shot. I loved the cinematography of it.
Yeah, especially the external ship shots. I thought were really beautiful.
Yeah, the effects were well done. Some of the interior stuff that's done in really dark spaces, I really enjoyed. That one sequence when, like, all you see are the lights of the phasers. You know what I mean? Like, there were nice little touches like that that I really enjoyed. The visuals of this episode were very compelling.
Yeah, exactly. Gorgeous to look
visually
at.
Probably my favorite episode of the series, visually.
Oh, great.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed just the way that it was directed.
There was a scene, you mentioned the dark spaces, if I can interject, where like Lorca has lured the Emperor into a trap, and we see these red lights go off. I'm not sure, was that meant to be reminiscent of the scene in First Contact?
I don't know, but it sure is, isn't it?
It sure reminds you of that, though. Yeah, it does. I think we all thought that when we watched it.
Oh, yeah, instantly, I'm like, oh, this is like First Contact, yeah.
But it's still a cool trick, even though it is repeating.
Yeah, it's a good theme. It's a good motif to borrow, for sure.
Yes, it absolutely is.
I also think that's just a nice little tip of the hat to Mr. Frakes for his contributions to the series, where they took an image from his excellent film.
Could very well be.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah, so I liked that part of it. I liked the Saru sequence when he kind of rallies the troops and steps forward, basically, to become acting captain of the Discovery. I really enjoyed that bit of it. Other parts of the episode I didn't love so much, and we can get into that in a bit.
Okay.
How about you, Jared? What did you think?
My general reaction is mainly the same. I still, as yours, I enjoy watching the way the episode is put together. I like this mirror universe plot so much better than the Klingon storyline. And I'm so grateful that there's none of these interruptions where, you know, it's just actors struggling to get these words out that they don't understand. I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah.
I really liked seeing, and I should look up her name before I say it, the lady who was on Battlestar Galactica, who had been like the security chief.
Rekha Sharma.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I liked seeing her back. I like her as a performer, and you know, she was such a mean person in the Prime universe that not much of a change for her in the Mirror universe. Basically,
yeah, she doesn't seem to be terribly bright in either universe either.
No, they tease her about the whole she's kind of maybe less mean even in the Mirror universe on After Trek. They even say, hey, I think you even smile more in the Mirror Universe than you do.
Maybe. All that time in the agony booth did her good.
Apparently.
I guess so.
Loosen stuff up, you know?
Yeah, apparently. Cleared her head a bit.
Yeah.
She was great, though. It was good to see her again. I think we all kind of figured we'd see her, but still, it was it was fun.
I think that Tilly and Stamets have a wonderful chemistry together, and I think they're like a good age for each other in terms of like a mentor-protege type relationship.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I thought the stuff that they did with the Spore Drive was always good to watch. It's just nice and Star Trek-y.
Definitely.
Something that's occurred to me with the two of them, and then also, and I don't even know her name, kind of the lady on the bridge with the implant of some kind.
Arian.
Where she, thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. is the in terms of diversity, they have really overrepresented redheads in a way that.
You're talking about Detmer. I'm sorry.
There we go. Detmer. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, because like you'll see these articles that say 100 years from now, there will be no redheads on the planet.
It's really fun. Jared, that's so funny. I was just thinking about that same thing.
Oh, there we go. Good. I've read your mind.
Also in commercials, there's a commercial that literally has two redheads working in the same office with each other, talking to each other. And I had that exact, it's that same kind of thought of like, wow, this only on TV, statistically, right? Like only on TV when we've assembled these actors and actresses, could this really happen?
Yeah. Or superheroes' girlfriends. I don't know what it
is. Yes. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I cut you off.
Anyway, that's something I've been sitting on for a little while. Something I do like, the other thing, while we're talking about some of the supporting characters, I really like the consistency of seeing the same faces of the in any other series that we would describe them as red shirts, of the mm-hmm. people who are just mm-hmm. in the bridge or otherwise. Something that always kind of bugged me on Voyager is the idea that there's like 150 people on this crew. People are dying left and right constantly, and I never felt like there I was seeing the same faces in the background the way I wanted to and expected to, but I do with this, and I really appreciate that. I think that's a good continuity touch.
Very good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All righty, so let's get into the meat of the story here, the Lorca Giorgio Burnham plot. Matt, what were your thoughts on this?
Oh, well, so this is, of course, kind of the meaty part of the Mirror Universe now. That's where we're at, mm-hmm. is this meaty kind of three-way, you know, allegiance that Burnham feels. Because, of course, there's this pull towards Lorca as someone she thought was a reputable, maybe a bit tough captain. And, of course, the inverse is much stronger, which is Lorca is definitely pulled towards Burnham. He has all these feels that we didn't know until recently. That he was both a mentor and a lover to Mirror Universe Burnham. So he has a definite, you know, weakness and pull towards her. And then the other sort of part of this, you know, Burnham triangle is of course that she, Burnham, I mean, but again, in both universes, has a strong pull towards Giorgio, because uh-huh. that was her mentor. And then, you know, that she finds out that the Mirror Universe version of her, that was actually her adopted mother. And so you can see this, you know, strong pull both ways with Burnham.
As well as guilt. I mean, I think yes, there's also absolutely. Guilt there, because it's
her fault. Oh, absolutely.
Prime universe, Giorgio is dead.
Right, absolutely. And of course, that totally motivates her final sort of actions with this version of Giorgio by saving her. That's all guilt, I think, you know. So. Yeah.
We can get into that, but I think it bears saying, though, that all of the things that Matt just described play out in the larger plot that goes on during the episode.
Oh, definitely.
It essentially informs all the decisions that get made.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Like, you know, I think everybody knows. Obviously, Giorgio is the emperor of this universe. Lorca is now intending to take over.
Right. He had a failed coup from power. Before.
Right. Sort of coup.
So he's trying again.
Right. And she ultimately, Giorgio, I believe, is captured at one point. No, she goes into hiding. I apologize. She goes into hiding, correct?
Yes.
Right. And then ultimately she and Burnham come up with this gambit that they will basically give him, as Burnham says, give him pretty much exactly what he wants.
Yes.
And they end up doing what our friend Tony Pascal likes to refer to as the Wookiee prisoner trick.
Yep. It's the old Wookiee prisoner trick.
The old Wookiee prisoner trick.
It is.
So they bring her in there, and Gabriel Lorca basically turns into a Bond villain. There's just a lot of It gets kind of like, I don't know. How would you describe it, Matt?
Well, no, I think, unfortunately, maybe that is a perfect thing to say, especially with the wonderful kind of delivery that Jason Isaacs does, because it's not really, you know, to say this isn't really like derogatory in a way, it's kind of like campy and fun, right? Like, mm-hmm. Lorca becomes one of these sort of amazingly over the top kind of 70s Bond villains, right? In a way, yeah. In a way. And it's yeah. and in that sense, it's kind of perfect for the Mirror Universe, which is already pulpy and kind of potentially could be campy, although this version is not so much. But mm-hmm. can but
the,
be.
The concept is campy, yes.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I think it's very fitting in that sense. But yeah, it also collapses Lorca a little bit, you could say, you know? Like from,
yeah, it does.
Anyway, and certainly his own attachments to Burnham most definitely blind him to the fact that this is totally, you know, the Wookiee prisoner trick.
Right.
Which he's used himself a few episodes prior. Like, he was involved in this very trick to get to the Emperor not that long ago. So, you know, he could kind of, he should sniff this out, right? He should smell something is wrong with this. But his...
He's blinded by love, man. Yeah.
Or lust and power, because it's the Mirror Universe, but I don't know. But so, yes.
Yeah.
Are you saying maybe he sees things through a mirror darkly?
Oh, perhaps he does, Jared.
Yeah. I'm still just thinking of that scene in Nemesis where they show the picture of a young Tom Hardy with his head shaved and say, yes. Oh, this is Picard when he was a young man.
Oh, don't get me started on
I'm
that.
I'm sorry.
Yikes.
I'm sorry. Now, Matt, you had some additional ideas on this.
Well, I have to say, I loved when Burnham realizes that maybe the only way out of this is to just offer herself along with Giorgio, and I love the really kind of strong kind of almost FU to Lorca, where she says, "Yeah, I'll join you in this universe, but you've only got my mind. Like that's yeah. it." And I love that because, of course, she damn well knows that, you know, at this point she's well aware that Lorca's totally, you know, infatuated with her hat, you know, right. was in fact her lover, you know, her mm-hmm. mirror counterpart's lover. And so she's just like, no, this is not how this is going to go down. Yes, I will, you know, stay here and sort of, you know, fight the fight with you for your very Darwinian ideology, but that's it. Like, you go no further with me. I thought that was a really kind of great, like, pushback. I mean, it honestly could have maybe ruined her little gambit, but it was kind of a nice bit of pushback. And you can see, like, Lorca wants that so badly, he doesn't care, right? Like, he'll accept that he thinks that, you know, she's, her actions at the Battle of the Binary Stars show that in any universe, you know, she's this, you know, apex, you know, predator of Terrans, basically, no matter the universe, right? Mm. He thinks that. And he's that's the interesting part, is he's always thought that, and it's really a blind spot of his, because she's repeatedly reminded him through her actions and through her, you know, sort of speeches to him, that you think that, but that's not true at all. And she repeatedly acts in a more Starfleet manner. She repeatedly acts in a more ethical manner than he seems to see in her, right? Mm. So, just interesting.
So, what do you think about how much Lorca talks about destiny?
Oh, yeah. Well, Lorca's sure convinced that exists for him, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that he certainly is making his own luck. Once the first lucky act happens, yeah, sure. He gets mixed up in an ion storm. Yay, mirror, mirror, right?
What a coinkydink.
I know, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Another ion storm during transport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, but sure, that's fun. Like, how else do
you... Yeah, that's fine.
I mean, honestly, how else do you get to the Mirror Universe, right? Like, sort of normally, like, as a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, how would if it's determined that the spore drive is the revolving door for this one, how does just one person go through that?
Right, and the answer is you do it just like just accidentally. Right. Yeah. So certainly that's like, if he wants to read into that as being destiny, okay, that's kind of luck. But I feel like from that point forward, I don't think you can call anything he did luck or destiny, because he's clearly forging that path. Like, mm-hmm. he's the one, you know, actively seeking out Burnham, grabbing her from this shuttle, manipulating her, keeping her on in the crew, manipulating her. The fact that, you know, the war was on was this perfect cover for him to you know, sort of claim extraordinary need for his power, you know, as a captain and keeper. So I don't know if it's fate. He likes to think it is, that's for sure. And I do like that Burnham again kind of pushes back, not directly to him, but in that conversation she has with Giorgio while she's kind of hidden out in her, you know, like briefing room area, I think it was, right? And she says, like, no, you know, my actions are my own. I make these choices. Mm-hmm. And certainly there's truth to that too, you know?
Yeah.
So
I think that this notion that he believes that he's destined to be great and that fate plays a hand just feeds into the whole idea that he's, you know, a megalomaniac.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Megalomaniacs believe that they are destined for greatness, that right. fate has put them in that time, in that place to be
exactly.
that person to do that thing.
Which goes back to being a Bond villain, because they're usually megalomaniacs too.
Which, to be fair, is kind of an inverse of what Kirk says to Mirror Spock at the end of the first Mirror Mirror movie and movie episode. The whole idea that each revolution, there's one man who needs to...
With a vision.
There
right.
we go.
Right. You know? Very good. Very good point. For sure. It's the inverse of that.
Yep.
Yep.
What did we think of the fight sequences in this? Were they appropriately thrilling?
So I think they were pretty kick-butt.
Yes, they were very well executed.
I will say that...
No pun intended.
Executed. Yeah.
Sorry.
The only nitpick, and it's kind of a typical action movie trope, so in a way you can't fault them, but oh man, there's a whole throne room of people who can't hit Burnham.
Yeah.
It's like, really? Okay, fine, whatever. We'll allow it. Other than that though, yeah, I thought it was really cool. And of course I loved that how just sort of organically, it's a little forced for a minute, but it's mostly organically somehow the throne room is eliminated down to where you just have, you know, basically this trio fighting it out.
Mm.
That's pretty cool. Like, it's a pretty darn cool scene.
Yeah, I like that there's one bit where she, like, shoots a door and goes and, like, slides into it to escape.
Yes.
And something that and maybe we've talked about this already, but I wanted to go into a little more detail about it, though, with the idea of how futuristic small unit tactics are depicted. Star Trek has always felt very much, you know, like a cowboy movie where there are people who hide behind stuff and they shoot at you and then you shoot at them, right? Mm-hmm. And it's always been a little bit, I don't want to say dumb, but it's like it hasn't extrapolated like the level of technology that these people would have. And so I always think, like, when they go into fights or whatever, why don't they have more advanced, like, if you're going into combat with someone who can disintegrate you, right? Why don't you have some sort of defensive measures for it? And so I really liked when we saw that the Empress had a force field that she activated.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I thought that was cool.
A transporter to bail.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, tactical use of the transporter should be happening all the time.
Exactly, something you think would happen more, yeah.
Yeah, and that's also, I mean, I guess that's kind of what happened at the end of the Klingon storyline when they were on the Burnham was in that big dramatic fight and then they beamed her out. It was kind of similar there. So it's nice to see that they're thinking a little more three-dimensionally with some of this kind of stuff. So so that's something I appreciate.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I have to interject, and Matt, we were talking about this before. I'm not 100% convinced that's Michelle Yao doing all of her own fighting. I think that might be a stunt double.
Here and there, maybe, yeah, for the more difficult stuff.
Yeah,
because there were just enough shots where we just see somewhat the back of a long head of dark hair, and I'm like, I'm not 100% convinced that's her based on how they framed the shot.
Well, Michelle Yeoh is, what, 55, 56 years
old?
Yeah,
yeah. She's earned the right to not have to do the hard work if she doesn't want to.
Yeah,
that's true.
Exactly.
That is true.
Yeah.
But she was great in this episode.
Yeah,
always.
It's delightful to have her back, even if she's evil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, even if she's evil, it's great.
Okay, so what do we think about Lorca's ultimate fate? I mean, the battle happens, and Burnham's got the drop on him and says, you know, you could have asked us for help, we would have gotten you home, kind of a thing. And she's going to spare him. She is actually going to spare
him.
Yeah, yeah.
Goal he's
the
done.
Phaser deactivates and everything, yeah.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, the sword goes right through his chest. Giorgio has killed him, and he ultimately gets dumped into that mycelial trapdoor thing, which was foreshadowed beforehand. I mean, you don't show that and not follow up on it later. I know they did it as kind of a gag earlier, which is one of the better moments in the episode, frankly, when they go to execute Stamets, and Lorca indicates that he's going to, you know, kill him with his own creation, like drop him right into the center of that mycelial drive that they have.
It's poetic justice.
It would be poetic justice to do that to you, and then Landry ends up disintegrating him, and then he goes, "Well, I hate poetry."
Yeah,
that was a great moment.
That's a good moment.
I didn't think about that. That's clever.
Yeah,
but I figured they weren't gonna just have that. That was clearly a setup for something else. So ultimately, Gabriel Lorca gets tossed down into the mycelial drive and
pulled apart, I guess.
He gets kind of broken up as he falls. What did we think of that, guys? Did we like the way it all ended for Gabriel Lorca, or what?
I mean, I had enjoyed Lorca's presence through the whole first season, and I was wondering what was going to happen with him. I certainly didn't want him to, you know, I guess we point out, become a Bond villain and perish in this way. But having said that, I'm glad they very clearly showed him as dead as could be, so there's no, maybe they'll bring him back next season kind of speculation, right?
Yeah.
So I do like that they tied a bow on it and said, okay, here it is.
What do you think, Matt?
I thought it was, to go back to sort of the Bond villainy, again, it's kind of a great way to go out. Like, he went out like a Bond villain.
Yes, he did.
Like you'd sort of expect in this pulpy, campy Mirror Universe world. So I think that's very fitting. I like that part a lot. It's always funny because, you know, him being pulled into pieces into this mycelial orb, well, that kind of means he went and became a piece of a part of the network, right? So they sort of have a little very, you know, science fiction-y way to, if they wanted to, and of course, really, if Jason Isaac's schedule allowed and things like that, there is this, maybe there's a way to resurrect him, right? They left that little door open. I don't think it's going to happen, but they left that door open, you know what I mean? By killing him in that manner, let's say.
And there is another Gabriel Lorca out there.
That's the more likely event, idea, well, I think.
Well, except for they basically explain that away, too. It seems like both Lorcas are gone, because he transposed with his prime counterpart, and then his prime counterpart blew up on the ISS Buran.
Oh, that's right.
When Giorgio hunted them down. So it sure seems like both Lorcas are gone. So, yeah. But as we know, you're never really dead. So I don't know. But that does not mean I expect him back for season two. A lot of people are clinging on to this as some shred of hope that he'll be back.
A lot of people like him in the role. Jason Isaacs.
Well,
it's hard not to like him.
And to be clear, yeah. I didn't say I didn't. I actually really liked. I really liked Lorca. Well, before he became a one-dimensional villain, I really liked Lorca with the nuance that there was there.
Yeah. I have to admit, I'm disappointed. I thought the character had a nice amount of nuance, and there was a lot of shading to the character.
Yeah.
To see him degraded into this one-dimensional villain is very disappointing, to be honest with you. That he's basically just a mustache-twirling villain.
Yes.
It was disappointing.
You know, and that's also what eventually happened with Gul Dukat in Deep Space Nine, is he's this amazingly three-dimensional character for the first six seasons. And then in the seventh one, they're just like...
He's a raving lunatic, basically.
Yeah. There's no...
That's right. That always bothered me. Yeah.
Well, those Paw Wraiths, man, they'll mess you up.
They will. They will. They don't kid around. Okay, I'm looking at what it says about the Prime Universe Gabriel Lorca on Memory Alpha, and it says, "The fate of the original Lorca and the precise timing of his replacement by his mirror counterpart remains unknown." So.
That is true. They don't
The door could be open.
They leave it a little unclear, but it sure seems like that's where they're leading us, is that since they flip-flopped, he dead too, you know?
Yeah. So he... You know, obviously, like we said, is this one-dimensional villain, and they make certain allusions to current events, which we are not going to get into here.
No, let's just say it's very 2016 of them. You know what I mean? Yes,
and a little on the nose.
Yeah.
About making the Empire great again, and basically the idea of aliens overflowing their borders and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a little silly considering you're running a galactic empire. What borders are overflowing? You keep conquering
yeah.
them. Like that's a little like, huh? You just conquer them. What are you talking about?
Yeah,
you know, it's always been weird to me that there are so many empires in Star Trek and so few conquered peoples.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, shouldn't the Romulans have had some blue aliens as a servant class on their warships or something?
Absolutely. Yeah. Same with the Klingons, for that matter.
Oh, the Klingons in particular, yeah.
I mean, they annexed all kinds of space in theory, you know?
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Anyway, that was a bit on the nose. I think I could have done without that kind of
as
blatant.
As other folks have said, allegory. I don't know how well that will age.
And I would like to do an episode where we of the Shuttle Pod where we talk about, is Star Trek really as good at social commentary as we sometimes say it is? And one of the liabilities of trying to do too much social commentary is you can peg yourself to the time in a way makes the episode age really badly.
I think if this is Jason Isaacs' swan song on Star Trek, he went out with a bang. You could tell was having a blast.
Absolutely. Eating, you know, chewing the scenery and just having fun with it. It's awesome.
But chewing the scenery in just the right way.
In the perfect way to do it.
He is such a pro, Jason Isaacs. He's such a pro. He and Michelle Yeoh, it's like you watch the two of them work and it's just like, it's a pleasure to watch them just go about their business.
Yes.
It's kind of one of those things where it's like a two-edged sword because he's so good that he kind of overwhelms Sonequa Martin-Green as the lead actress, right?
Sometimes.
I think, when he's not in a scene, he's the focal point usually, that's for sure.
Yeah. Although I have to say, I liked how, I do like that she was able to sort of anchor herself and hold her own in those final scenes with him. I thought, you know, Sika did a good job holding her own against
him. She did.
Yeah.
All right, so we get to the end of this whole sequence. Lorca has been vanquished. He's off to mycelial heaven. And there's a bunch of troops that come. I guess a bunch of Lorca's followers end up coming into the throne room.
Yeah.
And they're basically there to take out whoever was left
in this case. They're there to depose the emperor, basically.
Right. And Giorgio tells Burnham to go back to the Discovery and that she'll stay behind and fight and go out with whatever honor I think she could go out with, even though she's the deposed emperor. I forget exactly how she phrased it.
But that's the gist of it,
So you guys keep using the word depose, and I have this vision of these armed troops coming to record her statement for a lawsuit. Like, we need to is that the same word in both contexts?
I thought that was maybe I used it wrong, but I thought it was also
I think you're right. It's just, I just got a kind of silly image in my mind. Anyway.
It's all right. It's okay.
Yeah, anyway. It's monarchs who lose their throne as well. But you're right, it's both things. That's kind of funny. Just this guy with a little steno pad. Hey, can I get your deposition?
Here's your official statement before we kill you.
There's a class action
lawsuit from the planet of Andor against the
exactly.
Empire for damage.
They're not happy with you, Emperor.
Yeah. The loss of life was too severe. We need a class action. Yeah.
We need remediation.
Yeah. Oh, God. Anyway. That's a different universe, I'll tell you.
Yeah. So, there's a bunch of back and forth that starts to happen with gunfire. And Burnham is now suddenly being beamed off the ship toward the Discovery and makes a last second decision to grab a hold of Giorgio and take her with her.
Yep. This is interesting.
Yeah. What do we think of that, guys? Because I thought that was insane.
Yeah. Personally, I think the right choice was to let her stand her ground and die with the kind of, you know, Terran Empire dignity that she wanted. I don't see the point in this exactly, you know?
Yeah, why would you want to spare her? She's a genocidal monster.
We just watched her decimate an entire planet surface because, you know, there was one camp of rebels on it, right?
Mm-hmm. She fed Burnham...
A Kelpian.
A sentient being.
Yeah.
right. It's a delicacy, you know?
She murdered her inner circle because one sentence was uttered.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is not a good person. I mean, and that's one thing they did in this episode that was driving me crazy. Like, they try to say that Lorca is somehow a much nastier worse. Person than Giorgio, when in my mind, they're the exact same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they're both vile.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're product.
Repulsive
yeah.
human beings.
Right. Indeed.
Like the worst examples of humanity that you could think of.
Right. Somehow Burnham just sees this, you know, and that's what's bad, right? Like, she's just as, I mean, you could really argue that just as blinded as Lorca is about this, you know, version of Burnham, this perfect version of Burnham that he thinks he can craft, right, that he thinks he sees, you could definitely argue that the inverse kind of thing of Burnham thinks that she sees this perfect version of Giorgio that's not there. She's just as blinded.
No,
she's just as blinded by that kind of, by her guilt and, you know, want to have this Giorgio be her Giorgio. This is a terrible choice.
Yeah. But it's odd, too, the way the show kind of wants you to align with her.
It does. Yes, very much so. It definitely pushes you in that direction.
Yeah. It's just a very odd way to go. And now she's on the Discovery. She's in the Prime Universe.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen with her? I mean, we don't have to get into...
We should jump down to that, yeah. Like,
yeah, at the end, I usually don't watch the next week on Discovery, but I watched this one.
Okay, well, okay, I wasn't going to get so into it because I know you normally don't, Jared.
That's good. I'm glad you did, though, because I'd like to talk about it at the end just because it totally sets us up, you know, for stuff.
It appears that she is going to become some sort of, at least based on those, the teaser, and who knows, some of that could be misleading.
Yeah.
But it appears that she's going to become some sort of military advisor for Starfleet to help them defeat the Klingon Empire.
You know, it takes a nasty person to get nasty and beat these Klingons. And it's like, well, okay, really?
Yeah.
We have to abandon our principles sort of by proxy through this person to win?
Now, assuming like that we're reading it correctly.
Yeah, I don't like that.
That means that Starfleet is willing to get in bed with someone who's committed genocide on a massive scale.
Right.
Also, they could win this war. Compromise your principles and win the war. Now, we're speculating. We don't know this for certain.
But that seems likely.
That's certainly the way it looks.
It is a theory that fits the facts.
Yes.
It does.
We'll have a lot more to say next week once we know for sure, I think.
Yeah. So that made my eyebrow, my Vulcan eyebrow go up.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
It also seems like one of those things where the show is more interested in the actress than the character being played, right? Because they like having her around more on screen.
We
all
do. Well, of course we do. Absolutely, yeah. I like having her around too, but you know what that says to me? They should have spent 4 episodes setting up the pre stuff. You know what I mean? I would have liked to see a hell of a lot more time. Just personally, I could watch a whole show with Burnham and Giorgio on the Shenzo doing stuff.
Which is what I wish the whole first season had been.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah,
cool. I agree with that. I would have loved to have seen at least half of the first season been that, so we know these people. We know what it means when she gets betrayed, so to speak. So hell, I'd love to see more of that.
And it would also make the Mirror Universe episodes have a little more weight to them because you would know the characters better.
Yeah, indeed.
You know, you're seeing the dark opposites of these people, but let's face it, we don't know these people that well yet either. So it's, you know.
Right. Well, that's always a risk with doing something like that early on.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so we had a cool sequence where we see things from Stamets's POV through the mycelial network, and it seems like it's regenerated itself, so that's all needed to have more spores grow. So it seems kind of like it's not the end of the spore drive. I mean, we assumed that for continuity's sake, spore drive had to go away or be ruined in some way or contaminated. But now it seems like it's not. So what do we think about that?
Well, it's interesting because before we get to sort of the mechanics and the cool part of him figuring his way home, just that part is interesting, right? So they end up sort of fixing it by blowing up the giant mycelial energy sphere at the center of the Charon, right? And okay, so then they sort of, you know, fix the problem. So the network itself is now apparently healthy-ish or, you know, getting healthy. But they still need, of course, like a ship would need more spores to feed it, right, to actually use the drive, the spores are all still sickly. But that still just means, like, okay, so at some point, won't they grow more healthy ones? And then the spore drive's back in action? Which is weird, because, like Jared was saying, like, we know that this shouldn't be viable at a certain point. For, you know, whatever it is, at some point, this has to become not viable and and not used again.
Yeah.
I think we all really thought, well, this, you know, this sickness slash corruption was probably the way that they draw it to a close, right? They just go, okay, it's time to move on from this. But it sure looks like it just fixed itself, and now you just need to grow more healthy spores. Yeah, I don't know. So that's kind of unexpected, I guess, in that way. Like, I didn't think they would go so definitively sort of back towards the positive of that. Like, oh, it looks like it's all fine now, you know?
The one thing I noticed is a little strand of pixie dust landed on Tilly's shoulder. Did you guys notice that too?
Yes, it did. Oh yeah.
So does that mean, like, she's going to be infected, or what does that mean?
I don't know. That's a good question. It certainly seems like that's your little, perhaps quite literally too, little seed of hope for the, you know, for the spores to regrow. And of course, everyone's wanted to know, and Ted has been asked, and of course won't tell us. He on After Chuck, he was asked and said, I'm not going to tell you, but he said anyway, it'll get picked up in season two. So,
oh, interesting. Okay.
That's also interesting, because I thought we were trying to move away from using the spore drive because it's ruining canon, sort of. Not yet, but if they keep using it, it could sort of ruin canon, you know? So, I don't know. We'll see. It just seems like they're giving themselves an out, you know, a possibility.
Brian, any other thoughts on the spore drive?
No, I did. I thought that the way they did it was kind of cool, and because it was a very Star Trek-y, technobabble bit of nonsense that actually kind of made sense in a way. You know, okay, we're gonna torpedo this thing, and it's gonna create these shock waves of like spores, and we're gonna ride the waves. I mean, that was kind of fun.
Oh, that was cool. Like, yeah. That no question about that.
It was that was a fun little thing.
Yeah, that was good right Star Trek technobabble. Yeah,
it was the right amount of technobabble, and it all kind of, in the context of the Star Trek universe, it all kind of made sense.
Sure.
So that was fun. But yeah, I have to agree with Matt. I don't know where they're going with this spore drive.
Yeah. I have no idea what's going on. I just don't understand that, yeah. But yeah, the doing of it, this execution of their plan was awesome. Looked cool. Was very Star Trek-y. Like, no complaints there. None at all. It's very cool.
What did you think of it, Jared?
Oh, I thought particularly the action sequence where they flew through the Quantum 13 or whatever it is to blow it up. Mm-hmm. I thought that was beautiful. And then to be able
fired
to see things
when they fired the proton torpedoes into the exhaust port.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Because Burnham, had disabled the shield. Yeah. Obi-Wan Burnham.
Yes.
Yeah, that worked well.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Okay, so now, of course, someone else who gets a chance to shine in all of this is the new captain of the Discovery. And how did he do with leading his troops into battle?
Well, I think this is another just excellent, excellent Star Trek moment. You know, this is, like, to its credit, another really great scene and bit of, you know, dialogue in this episode with Saru's, speech to his crew. And really, it's nice to see Saru, who was, you know, he's second in line for the chair, but Lorca was such an overpowering, you know, captain. We don't really know what Saru's like as a leader, but now we do. Now we got a really good taste of Saru, and it's nice to see this. It's nice to see him step out because, you know, in the beginning, I think Saru was all sort of a person that we kind of chuckled at his somewhat ridiculous tagline that they kept putting in the previews about sensing death coming.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, that was beautiful, the way they bookended the series.
Exactly.
By having him turn it to say, I don't sense it now, right? That's good.
Exactly. It's great because it was almost a little bit over the top and kind of a joke in a way, the way they delivered it at the beginning. It's like, oh, this guy's really one note. He is not, but remember, in those first trailers, we all kind of wondered about that. And of course, he's not at all. And Doug Jones does a fantastic job with the role and has all season. And yeah, they work that in and they kind of flip it around, and he uses it as a vote of confidence. You know, it's like, hey, I don't sense it now. That means we're going to, you know, tech the tech, and we're going to figure it out, and we're going to be victorious. And that's really great. It was a really great speech. It's the kind of thing that you want to hear, and I feel like we so desperately needed to hear from a really uneven and very dark many times season, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's especially dark when we're hanging out in the Mirror Universe. It's pretty grim at times in the Mirror Universe. But the whole season has been kind of dark, right? So I think this is a really great way to sort of sum up their time ending, you know, this arc ending.
It was a very good Star Trek moment.
Yeah,
for sure.
In a season that sometimes didn't have a lot of them, to be honest.
Mm. Right. Exactly.
I also like to return to what I said earlier, how we got all the nice reaction shots from the supporting crew.
Oh, yes.
You're like, yeah, very we're good. Being inspired. And I really want to learn more about the robot in the background.
Not a robot. Augmented human.
Oh, okay. Cyborg, then.
Yeah. Yes. Arium. Yeah, we want to know more about her for sure. The other nice thing is that they weren't just reaction shots. They did the kind of montage of figuring things out and getting things ready.
Yeah, and he's calling out orders, and they're like, yes,
yeah, Captain, you know, and they're actually responding, and sometimes he's actually asking for input. And Arium, who's the augmented person, who's the spore drive officer, actually kind of says a few things and gets some input. And so it's really nice to see this whole, hey, wait, you mean the bridge crew actually kind of knows what they're doing and you know should actually have a meeting and should bring their expertise to the captain, like we know a Starfleet vessel should, you know. It's nice to see.
Yeah, and shout out to Doug Jones, who is ridiculous. He's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. How this guy acts through, you know, latex.
I don't know how he does it. Yeah, and his voice, his vocal control is so good, and it's such a complete performance from top to bottom.
Whole body acting right there.
Yeah, it really mm-hmm. is. It's truly remarkable work.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope, I mean, the Academy, the Emmy folks are not known for recognizing genre stuff, but
no.
He needs at some point to get some recognition for his performances.
Oh, definitely. Saru.
It's really impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are plenty of sci-fi specific awards that he has a chance to be recognized with.
This is true.
So, what did we think about the ending? The 9 months in the future.
So that's interesting. Like, we won't be able to really judge a ton of it until the next episode, I think. But I found it interesting, and kind of it makes sense because that whole part of Stamets trying to, you know, he's lost in the forest, which, my gosh, if you think about that, of course you would be. Like, think about the fact that, like, trying to make a spore jump. I mean, this is exactly why it requires, you know, a living being who sort of is adapted to it, right? Because there's, as he says early on, as, you know, Stamets points out early on, the jumps are probabilistic. And the longer the jump, you know, the more the crazy outcomes, you know, that you're sorting through, basically, right? So yeah, can you imagine, like, all the probable, you know, probabilities of this, that he's trying to get back to a time, a place, and a universe. You know, it's like, wow, I don't know how you do that, right? And of course we had Hugh, you know, Hugh Culber sort of reach out to him again, and or the Mycelia Network itself, because that's sort of, maybe that's what that is, we're not really sure.
It's just how he perceives it.
Right. Reach out to him and sort of, you know, we kind of had, actually, to go back to Star Wars again, we kind of had a Luke let go kind of moment, right? You don't need to use the, you know, Luke, you switched off your targeting computer, what's wrong? You know, it's like, no, it's fine. He just let go, and he let the Mycelia Network kind of guide him to the appropriate spot. And of course, well, it's almost the right spot, right? Like, well, physically, it's the right spot, but temporally, he's about 9 months off. And that's, right. I could see that. Like, I buy that, because it's like, well, sure, you're fatigued. You just barely recovered from having your brain scrambled by the Mycelia Network, and you're trying to fight to get back to where they should be. So, sure, okay. Plus or minus a few months, totally makes sense.
I agree. It totally makes sense.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, they get back. It's 9 months later, and apparently the Federation is in the midst of losing the war to the Klingon Empire.
Yeah, pretty badly, it looks like.
Yeah, based on that map, I mean, there's very little... there are very few Federation strongholds left.
Yeah, from the map, it looks like maybe only the core worlds of the Federation are still standing,
yeah.
You know? And that's about it. So, that's pretty bad.
Do we think, since the Spore Drive catapulted these guys 9 months into the future, can they go back into the past and try to curtail this bloodbath?
Yeah, I think the speculation part is, yeah, I kind of have this feeling that... I don't love this, but I kind of have this feeling like we may be having a little reset button.
Like, oh, happen. Interesting.
That sort of fixes it all, and then, you know, it's like, oh, let's fix it all, and then let's never use the Spore Drive again, and then let's just not talk about that. You know, that's the way it reconciles sort of with canon, right? Is if they sort of fix the Klingon War and make it resolve itself, you know, reasonably quickly and never use the Spore Drive again. I don't know, but I have this sort of fear that that's sort of where it's going to go, you know?
Yeah. They've got a lot of ground to cover in the next two episodes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The thing I wonder if they're going to try to do with that reset button is like a Yesterday's Enterprise type of thing.
Mm-hmm. I think that might be exactly it. Feel. Yeah.
Oh, how about this? How about how frequently the phrase "no win scenario" was thrown around? Was that okay, or was that a little too much?
Maybe you made that one too many times.
Yeah.
But I thought it was Stamets repeats
it. When Stamets repeats it again, I was like, okay, yeah. We got it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Blue milk, did you know? It's like, yes, we know. We know Kobayashi Maru, right, we get it. Yeah. But it was fun, and again, aside from maybe the third being too many, a nice kind of rallying, good bit of dialogue and inciting
when
the
Saru references it, he uses it the right way. Absolutely.
Yeah,
he uses it the right way.
Anything after that was too much. Was a little too much.
Agreed.
Yeah, it was blue milk, no question.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
Anyway, so we're 9 months in the future. There's a war going on. I mean, are we back in the exact Prime universe? Maybe we're not.
And that's a good question. Because maybe we're not. Maybe we're in a, you know, sort of extra fork of what might happen. You know,
right. I mean, we're talking. Mycelial network is tied into the multiverse, so there are literally infinite diversities and infinite combinations.
Exactly. So. So this is the "what if the Discovery never made it back" version of that, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. So who knows? I mean, we obviously will find out soon enough, but that's definitely a possibility.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Which then kind of goes back to my "it's almost a reset button" thing. If somehow they figure out how to reconcile things, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we'll see. But in the meantime, since we all have seen the little preview for next week, and you know what, too bad, we're going to talk about it because it's out there and it's attached to the episode. So they sure look like they're doing the thing where they go, we mentioned this earlier, but it sure looks like they're doing this thing with they need Emperor Giorgio to tell them how to make some kick-ass like weapons and like push forward to like really kick the Klingon's ass back, you know, to where their territory was. And I don't know about that. We'll see. They certainly talk like that in the way it's cut together, that little preview teaser.
Well, if that's what they need, they shouldn't bring an evil emperor from another universe to come save the day. They should go out and find a genetic Superman that's like Sherlock Holmes.
Ah, bingo. You know exactly where I was going with that. I had the exact same thought.
Yeah, sorry to jump on it.
You're fine.
Sorry, also, it makes Starfleet look like a bunch of schmucks.
And that's what it does. And that's what I think is the most annoying part about it all, is they look incompetent. They look like they are too used to doing, you know, exploratory things and have no idea how to defend their own borders, right?
Yeah.
And that's just simply not true. And we see that, you know, we've seen this time and again. Kirk is never afraid to push back, obviously, right? I mean, he has that reputation for a reason. Go look at the Borg threat. Go look at the Dominion threat. Sure, we're a peaceful exploration, you know, sort of paramilitary unit when we need to be. But don't push us, right?
Right.
We will respond. And that's what I think is, if this is where this is going, this is something that I think that the current group of producers and stuff have missed about Star Trek, which is that, sure, the ideal is that we explore, but it also serves, you know, Starfleet serves a function, a dual purpose, right? And so if you need to, we don't want to, but if you need to, we're also the first line of, you know, sort of first and last line of defense, right? So it's important. And I feel like if this is where they're going with it, they've missed that, and it does a disservice.
Yeah. And there are other historical figures. Garth of Izar was apparently like a major
he was one
figure in dealing with the Klingons in the past. Like, it's not like they're a bunch of, you know, tree hugging people who aren't capable of defending themselves.
Right, exactly. And that's one of those things that's bothered me a bit is, you know, all these, the few times we've seen them run battle drills, those guys don't seem to know how to shoot, you know? And it's like, wait, why? You should be a perfectly competent weapons officer. Why can't you seem to target Klingon targets, both in simulation and in real life? And then Lorca yells at you about it. And it's like, yeah, but you, these are supposed to be competent professionals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It also, I don't know how really well suited the emperor of a firmly established organization like the Terran Empire would be at that kind of fighting, right? She's never been in that kind of combat, right? It's always just been enforcing the norm that had already been established by the first emperor.
Right. So, yeah, good point. So there's all these sort of problems with this idea, and it really looks like they're setting it up that way. And I just, it's kind of, you can see like on the surface of it, they're like, oh, neat. You know, you can use this mirror universe sort of ruthlessness, but it's like, no. That defeats the entire point of saying that our people are both ethical and hopeful and also should be able to find a way to move the war forward and then also understand the Klingon point of view and come to some kind of end, right? Some kind of, you know, some kind of stalemate, which is sort of where we find it in TOS, where there's just this kind of grudging stalemate, you know, and occasional skirmish back and forth, which is where we sort of see it in TOS. I don't think it requires a crazy dictator from the mirror universe to get there.
No.
No, I don't think so either.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, there is the possibility that they are, that the producers do feel that Starfleet is what we, that they feel that Starfleet is this passive organization. So, I mean, we were reading an interview earlier today with Aaron Harberts, one of the executive producers, who said originally when Fuller was outlining the series, Gabriel Lorca was not going to be from the Mirror Universe.
Right.
He was going to be a hawkish starship captain.
Right. And you know what? That's a type we have absolutely seen before. There's nothing wrong with that. Jellico comes to mind.
Yeah, Jellico was like that. Yeah.
Right.
Or Admiral Cartwright from Star Trek VI.
Yes. But they decided not to go in that direction because they felt like, well, why would there be such a hawkish captain in Starfleet? So their rationale then was that, well, we'll make him from the Mirror Universe. That's how we'll justify his behavior.
Yeah, and that's, again, see, that's concerning. That basically says, look, you don't understand that there's two sides to, you know, there's two sides to this, and that there's a range of personalities and, you know, types and missions to be done by Starfleet. Like, sure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Are you saying there's advantages to having a diverse group of people working in an organization? Yeah. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. Imagine that. Yeah. I know, right? That is what I'm saying. Imagine that.
Yeah.
So that's concerning too. We'll see where they go with this. We need to sort of reserve judgment, but it is kind of concerning. I will say in the preview stuff that we saw, I think this is actually part of the After Trek preview, but it looks pretty cool that I'm really glad that we see Admiral Cornwell again. I like her a lot. I think she's a really great kind of strong character that I would definitely like to continue seeing, you know, pop up. So she, of course, like, they're suspicious of why the Discovery just reappeared. And so Cornwall boards, and I like that she's no nonsense and, you know, uses a command code. Yay. Just like we've seen before to take over the functioning of the Discovery. because she's not about to just have this you know old, this really advanced ship reappear and then you know go free, right? Like she doesn't know what just happened, she doesn't know why it reappeared, she doesn't know where Lorca is, because she knows that, you know, the last thing she knew, Lorca basically nudged her in the direction of like death by sending her to that doomed meeting, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, even though she doesn't know that Lorca's from the universe, what she knows is Lorca was kind of a bastard to her, and Lorca was unstable, and she was going to go, you know, relieve him of his command. So she's not going to take any chances, you know, with this ship that just sort of appeared 9 months later out of the blue. That's exciting. Whatever goes on there looks exciting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we see Sarek with her. Yep. So I'm pretty sure he's about to go mind meld folks to figure out the real truth. You know what I mean? She's going to use him kind of amusingly like they did in the Mirror Universe as the Oracle, right? He's going to mind meld with people and determine the truth of what just happened for the 9 months they were gone.
Could be.
That's my assumption anyway.
Yeah, that is definitely... a lot to cover, as I said earlier, in these final two episodes. And I suspect we are in for at least one more giant twist.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you're right.
Like, we are coming up on the finale, and I'm sure there'll be another one. I, for one, am kind of done with all the twists.
Yes, it's fatiguing.
There's a few too many. It's a bit too much. Like, they packed them all in, one after the other, after the other.
Yeah.
It almost feels like we're watching a soap.
Or 24, right?
I mean, they always have
twists just for the sake of having twists.
Yeah, that was built into that format, though. That was practically like part of the way that show had to pay itself off.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, so, you know, twists are fine and dandy, but geez, man, you know.
Yeah.
Use them judiciously and space them out.
Yeah, I've kind of had enough.
So hopefully
I think we got one more, gang.
Hopefully it's a really good one and one that, you know, leaves us talking.
Do we have ideas of what the twist might be?
Mm-mm. I think we've kind of covered maybe possibilities, but I don't really know.
I don't really know either.
No. We shall see.
We'll find out. Yeah, we will find out soon enough, that's for sure. It's coming up fast. It's hard to believe. We're almost at the end of the season.
Yep. Yeah. Which kind of bums me out because it's been really great to have Trek back on, you know, back on weekly and talk about it weekly and think about it, analyze it, speculate.
It's been a long time since we've been able to obsess over something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Week to week.
Yeah.
So, I have a question for you guys. What did you think of the Mirror Universe arc as a whole? And do you feel it fits in with the larger arc that has been put in place throughout the season in terms of Michael Burnham's redemption and the war with the Klingon Empire? Do we feel it works within that framework, or do we feel it's its own thing? What do you guys think?
I thought the theme was a little duplicative because we're dealing with this theme of, you know, especially with Captain Lorca being, you know, you used the word hawkish, with him being a non-traditional Starfleet captain in that way. We already see him going to extremes maybe other people would, maybe Captain Janeway wouldn't have, in the name of winning the war against the Klingons, and then we're catapulted into this universe and we're kind of doing the same thing again. Mm-hmm. So I mean, if I had to choose one of the two, obviously I picked the Mirror Universe one instead, but I thought it was weird to cram two of these larger arcs that seemed very similar in together. I thought it would have been better to do one of them this season and another one next season.
Right. In the same vein, it's hard for me to understand like cramming two arcs in. To go back to the thematic stuff though, there's certainly a theme for Burnham, since, you know, if we go back to really that Burnham is the central character, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a theme for Burnham in both of these, where we have an arc of sort of seeing sort of the worst of herself, like what her counterpart's legacy was. And then also, you know, sort of seeing that and going, okay, well, see, I'm not a terrible person. I could be. This is like the ultimate version of being a terrible person is whoever she was. I'm not. So it gives her this mirror, if you will, to judge herself against, which goes back to her, you know, redemption arc and things of that nature. So in that part, I think it's good. And I think that they really wanted to have, they really wanted to have her come face to face with Giorgio again as something interesting. And I think that was interesting. How they've continued to go with it, we'll see. I don't know. But in the theme sense, I think it was certainly interesting to then have to come face to face with her, you know, dead captain that was like a mentor and sort of mother figure, you know, to her.
Yeah. Sure.
But do I prefer this over the Klingon storyline? Gosh, that's, you know, this is the hard part. At this point, I actually feel like the Mirror Universe arc is a better fleshed out world than whatever mm-hmm. was going on with the Klingon
stuff. Yeah, absolutely. I have to agree with that. I have to agree with you on that.
And I hate that because, in theory, that was supposed to be a very interesting... it didn't necessarily in execution become this, but in theory, it was supposed to be a very interesting storyline. The way it was talked up, you know, at, say, Comic-Con and things of that nature, they were talking mm-hmm. about how it was supposed to be really interesting and different, you know, the two opposing points of view were supposed to be represented. And
certain... we were supposed to learn about the other.
Right. Now, that hasn't really happened in practice, I feel. But the potential, this interesting potential was there. And in the same vein, the interesting potential of Tyler and Voke is interesting. And again, I don't think it went anywhere. I hope with the last two episodes they do something about it. But see, he's, to go back to things and themes and metaphors, like, gee, you want to talk about a metaphor for someone who's quite literally split in between the two worlds and the two sides of this war. I can't think of a better metaphor than the Tyler Voke mm-hmm. one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they just kind of went, yeah, I can zap him with my creepy scalp massager, and that's the end of it. And I think yeah. that's, I mean, we'll see what they do with it. They only have two episodes, and it goes back to lots of storylines that they have to deal with, and I don't know if they can. It's too bad because I think it's a disservice to the two actors that are really heavily involved in this, which is, you know, Shahzad Latif and Mary Chifa, who do a fantastic job as actors. You know, Mary Chifa does a fantastic job acting through the makeup and really being interesting. Laurel has been very interesting the entire season. And now it just seems like, well, okay, she was interesting, but that's kind of over with, right? Like, what do we do with her now? And it bums me out because we were supposed to have a very, you know, deep and fleshed out arc with all this, and I don't know what's going to happen with that.
Interesting. I have a theory that, and I have no proof of this whatsoever. This is total speculation on my part. I suspect that some of the more political elements that we saw in the Mirror Universe arc were originally intended for the Klingon war.
Oh yeah, sure. I could
but
see that.
I think they realized at some point during production that the Klingons were not working out really well.
I think they pivoted
and focused more of the allegorical elements into the Mirror Universe arc.
Yeah, I mean,
that's total speculation. It is. I have no inside information or anything else.
It is, but you know,
it seems like all the things that we were told last summer are not manifesting themselves with the Klingons.
Yeah.
Everything's kind of just been thrown into the Mirror Universe.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I don't know if they'll ever admit that, but that was my theory.
Yeah. That's a good theory.
Yeah, it certainly seems to fit, doesn't it?
Like, yeah, and yeah. I remember things like how much the actors who were playing Klingon characters were featured on their social media, and like how you're thinking they're going to be a much bigger deal than really they turned out to be.
Oh, and that's and that's another bummer. Like, it just seems like a bit of a waste. Kenneth Mitchell, dude, he seems like he was really into being Cole. He was into it. He was really down for that, and then we don't see a ton of him. You know, and it's just like, oh, what the heck?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I think they clearly were not happy with the way things went with the Klingons.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, this makes sense.
I mean, let's face it, guys. The whole reason for setting this show and the time period that it's set in was ostensibly so they could depict this war between the Federation and the Klingon Empire,
mm-hmm.
and we've barely seen it.
Yep.
I mean, even when before the Discovery went into the Mirror Universe, it was still kind of this abstract concept half the time. There was not a lot of combat, ostensibly because the Discovery itself is this experimental ship and we can't risk it and all this stuff. So you never really got to see the war.
Yep. Yep.
Except for there was that one scene where the planet was being attacked.
Right. When it showed up and it did it, it kicked ass and then disappeared again.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the one that stands out. And the only other one I can think of that stands out is the USS Gagarin is under attack. And they jump in and try to help stop it.
Right.
And they can't prevent it from being destroyed. Right. But that's it. Yeah, those are the only really big sort of set pieces, of like the war that I can think of. And that doesn't make any sense.
No.
To go back to the war stuff and Deep Space Nine, we talk about, they've got millions of dollars and lots of, modern budget and, effects behind it. Right, so Deep Space Nine with, early CGI, which doesn't look too bad, honestly. Early CGI threw everything they could at it and totally showed frontline stuff. Okay.
Yes, they did. Those amazing shots.
Okay. So, and then we're supposed, this is, in this new era of long form storytelling, why can't we linger on the front lines for a little bit? Right. I don't understand.
Well, maybe we will.
I hope so. I really want them to. That's why in the article of, 11 things we want to see before the season kind of ends, that's one of the, kind of top items is like, you have to somehow show us the front lines of this war and understand how it resolves,
Yeah.
Yeah.
I personally don't feel like this Mirror Universe arc really fits into the core idea of this season. I do think it would be a fun thing to do. I think they probably would have been better to hold it till next year.
Yep.
Sure.
Because I also don't feel like we know these characters well enough yet to really appreciate the differences in them. And I would like to have seen, even if it was in flashback, I would have liked to have seen more of the emotional relationship between Burnham and Giorgio.
Yes.
I want to see, the problem you have with watching her, the two of them relate, and even watching Burnham relate to Sarek, is that you're told that they have these relationships. You don't get to see them, though. So, like, when Burnham is going through this whole mommy thing with Giorgio, I don't relate to it because I haven't seen them really, except for a little bit in the pilot. You've never really seen them together much. So you don't get that connection, that emotional connection. So I'm viewing it almost in a dispassionate way because it's important for the character in the story. It's not necessarily important for the viewer watching, at least for me.
Well,
so I would have been better, I think, to have maybe this kind of thing with all these opposites and, these emotional connections with these characters. I think it would have been better served to do with this Mirror Universe thing a little further down the line. That's my opinion.
You know what it kind of reminds me of is there's this scene in Attack of the Clones where Obi-Wan and Anakin are in an elevator talking about the fun adventures they've had. Wouldn't it have been better to just show us one of these fun adventures? Maybe that would have been more interesting than.
Although, see, Star Wars knows what's up. That's marketing because you need to go watch the Clone Wars cartoon.
Yeah. So anyway, it would have been cool to see that. It would have been better if Lorca had been with the crew more, and you could have kind of gotten used to him, and let everything fall into a routine a little bit.
Yes.
He's just the captain of the ship, and you let things fall into the background a little bit, and then when this finally would have happened, I think it would have been more of an emotional shock to the viewer and to the characters.
Sure, because then suddenly you're yanked out of this comfortable routine.
Yeah. I really do think it would have been better. This Mirror University would have been better served being pushed to next year. As it turned out, they actually pushed it further into the season than Fuller had it. Fuller had them going into the Mirror Universe in like episode 4 or
something. Really? That's crazy to me. That just blows my mind that he thought that was a good idea so soon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cool as heck. It looks really good. It had some fun and interesting points to it, for sure,
Yeah, but I don't know if I really needed it right now. But no. It was fine. Yeah. It was fun.
Okay. Well, any closing thoughts then?
No, just buckle your seatbelts. I think these next few episodes are going to move at even faster speed than the previous four have.
I expect to get a little whiplash with these, I think.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot packed in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot packed in, so pay attention.
And we'll be right there with you the whole time.
Yeah.
That's right.
Looking forward to it. Riding the ride.
Yep. Next week's episode is called The War Without, The War Within.
Mm. So. I do like the titles they've had. That's something I where they tend to give me little grins when I read the titles.
Yeah, they've been fun. I agree.
Okay, well, thanks for coming along with us on the journey. We appreciate the opportunity to have spent the last hour or so with you. Look forward to many more in the future. Farewell, friends.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.